Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Sarah Rudin. She is a leading translator of the ancient literature of the West, and we're talking about her new book, Reproductive Wrongs, A Short History of Bad Ideas About Women. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
I'll tell you, as soon as I read your title, I had to read this book. And it lived up to its title, which is great. It's great. But I have to ask you, as a person who's a translator of ancient literature and a literary critic, how do you come to write this very passionate history of reproductive freedom?
Well, I wrote it out of a really passionate desire to be useful. I spent most of my life until the age of 30 in libraries. And I've got a bit of brain damage, so when I found out that I could learn languages, but I couldn't do much else very well, I threw myself into rather isolated language learning. I started a Harvard PhD program at the age of 21. Don't do that. It's a bad idea.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Are you? I glanced out, over this, but are you seriously brain damaged?
Yes, I am. Yes.
But how are it's sort of not affecting your writing or reading abilities at all? Is it making it better? It's
like, I think so, because I am spectacularly bad at spatial things and mathematical things.
Okay.
So I had to. I don't really know at the end of the day how good I am at languages, but I worked very hard because I could see that this was the only chance I had for making a living.
Okay, yeah. You've written books. In fact, I want to mention you've written many books, but you've written books about the Apostle Paul. You've translated the Gospels. You've translated Augustine's Confessions. You seem to be the perfect person to write the book that we're talking about.
Well, I don't know, because I specialize in text, so I guess I developed a very good habit in a really confusing world full of upheaval. I developed this what I now think is an excellent habit of working up from a single word that I could understand very well through standard lexicons and commentaries and, material that's developed over literally thousands of years. Our great books are pretty well documented, well understood. So I could start with a single word and then work my way up slowly to an understanding of its context, and then I could think about its political and social meaning. I'll give you one example.
Sure.
In the Gospels, they do not translate diminutives. So where the Gospel says dogs, and Jesus is calling pagans dogs, it's really the word clearly in Greek is little doggies. And it's a comic word. It's very light. It's gentle. And it's in a teasing conversation with a pagan woman who's actually touching Jesus, how totally outrageous, and demanding a very important favor from him. He's got to save her little daughter. And they have an exchange which is based on the word little doggies, not dogs.
Huh.
So it completely changes the tone of the exchange and, I think, the meaning of the exchange.
Is part of the problem of many problems that are going on today that people have not correctly read many of these sources?
I think so. And this is fundamentally a problem of translation.
Yeah, all right.
Translation is controlled by, or has been, up to very recently, controlled by powerful institutions.
Meaning men.
Meaning men, yes, but well-ensconced men. And they want the important books understood a certain way. So they will just translate over, the actual meaning that is there.
How did you start becoming so politically agitated about it? First of all, I want to say that reading this book was a real amazing experience for me, because I knew some of it. I didn't know it altogether. And I ended up being surprised that women just don't kick men in the crotch every day. I mean that sincerely. It's like there seems to have been this sort of systematic, you know, sort of messing around with the role of women in a lot of things, in politics and the home life and stuff like that. And it's all found in the original source material, which thankfully you have read and translated. Were you always this much of a reproductive sort of person that was really standing up to the reproductive rights for women?
No, not at all. What really politicized me was that I spent around 10 years in the New South Africa.
Oh, doing?
That was the 10-year track job that I went out to. It was at the University of Cape Town.
So what happened to you there?
Well, I only lasted about 3 years at the University of Cape Town, got off the tenure track, did a lot of other really interesting things, including investigative journalism. And what I saw in South Africa really, really shook me up, but in a positive as well as a negative way.
You got to explain it. You have to explain it.
Oh, well, I saw women's welfare, you know, and women's voices as key to the welfare of entire societies.
Yeah.
And I saw how, you know, in the aftermath of a great cataclysm, there was a great tendency to scapegoat women, to make women responsible for everything, and to be quite sadistic toward women. And the way to do that most effectively was to attack them in the sexual and reproductive realm, where they were most vulnerable.
I think the thing I find most upsetting about that is it has a history. In other words, and the history is the history you cover in this book, going back to ancient Greeks and ancient Rome. There's been this systematic way of treating women as not humans, and not only as not humans, but as people that are causing the problems for the rest of the men.
Mm-hmm. I found that, you know, this mistreatment of women was central to the development of authoritarianism. And in its modern Western evolution. So we start out with Ovid's two.
I want to ease into that, okay?
So sure. Okay.
First of all, I have to say, as serious as your book is, and your book is very serious, you've written hilarious titles for these chapters. And when I got to the first chapter, I couldn't believe that I was reading Dawn of the Dicks. And it really cracked me up. And then I'm reading this really serious stuff. Now, let's cover women in the ancient world, in the Greek and Roman world. How were women viewed in ancient Greece, in classical ancient Greece?
Well, they were certainly denigrated. They were certainly exploited. But they were very well integrated into ancient societies.
So they weren't like shunted aside.
Oh no. They were the foundation of the home.
Okay.
So this mitigated their mistreatment. You know, we can talk about slaves and prostitutes, and
right.
Their mistreatment was pretty much unbridled. But, you know, wives had a certain position, so they enjoyed a certain amount of protection.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of the household was, the male head of the household was absolutely in charge. But the ancient pagans were very pragmatic, and this made them pretty stern about family planning. So they operated within their economic and social limits, and that meant they practiced family planning pretty brutally.
So, again, there's so much information in your book based on the fact that you've researched this. When you say family planning in ancient Greece, I think that's those are two phrases that most people have never heard together. So are they practicing birth control?
Well, they are. I don't know if you would call it birth control. What one means of family planning was infant exposure.
And that figures in several myths, too.
Right, yes. It was a very important idea. And it's wrong to say that they were simply cruel. They hated doing it. You can see it from the stories that they tell about it. They always dreamed that it would not be necessary, or you could somehow go back and retrieve that baby, you know, in the manner of, say, Moses.
But what did it actually involve?
It involved taking the newborn, and this was probably most of the girls who were born, and probably every boy after the second or third. You had to be careful, because if your children would die later, then you could come up short and not have an heir. We don't see that ordinary families would raise many children at all, maybe two or three. So you would take the newborn you didn't think you could raise, and place that baby in a public place outdoors, and the baby would probably be picked up by slave dealers and raised as a slave, probably would not die.
But they also had some choices for birth control, and this interested me no end, that there was this plant called silphium?
Silphium, yes. It became extinct because it was the most effective contraceptive. So it was used madly, and so much. It only grew in, you know, one small part of the world, so it became extinct. There were other chemical contraceptives and abortifacients. There were mechanical means of abortion. So this was something very regular, and, you know, something that the heads of households dictated, even if they didn't, you know, directly supervise it. They made the women responsible for it, but this was something that had to go on to keep families within the requisite size.
Now, moving to ancient Rome, which is a very different civilization, abortion was never outlawed outright, as you wrote. Why was it tolerated?
Well, there was a criminal law against abortion that arose, you know, some way into the imperial period. So we're a long way forward in Roman history,
right,
before that happens. Before that, it was not criminalized because, I would say, simply because it was a means of family planning that men wanted.
Now, you also write a lot about the roles women had in Roman society, besides being a wife. There were sex workers, and there was something, professional lovers, which I found really an interesting title. Who were they?
Well, they were courtesans, and
but they just weren't. They weren't prostitutes.
No, they were fashionable lovers. And they probably came from all over. Some would have been war captives in their childhoods. Some of them would be poor women who found a profession in the sex trade. And they were fairly sophisticated women, attractive women, who were companions for well-to-do men.
What happened if they got pregnant?
They would likely have an abortion.
Okay. And so did the wife know about the professional lover that the husband had?
This was really not her business.
Oh.
as long as the husband was discreet, a woman would never be inquiring into his affairs outside the home.
Now we come to Ovid.
Right.
Now, Ovid was one of my favorite ancient Roman writers up until now. And I love Metamorphosis and his sort of erotic poetry and stuff like that. And then I find out from you, he wrote these two crazy anti-abortion poems. Where did this come from?
Yeah, the abortion poems are just insane.
The anti-abortion, we should say.
Oh, yes, anti-abortion poems. They are nuts because you don't have any real anti-abortion literature. You know, people are, in ancient societies, Greek and Roman societies, they are discussing abortion. They are discussing the possible humanity of the fetus. There's civil liability for abortion if the husband is put out, inconvenienced by it. The hostility toward abortion just flames up apparently out of nowhere in the two anti-abortion poems of Ovid. And the question is, oh my word, why?
And the answer has to do with politics.
I think it absolutely does. Ovid is a court poet of the first emperor, Augustus. And Augustus was the first, I'm arguing, modern authoritarian.
Wow.
Super, super ambitious, highly dependent on propaganda, massively controlling, totally brutal. He basically wanted everything. And he was he was a Putin-like figure in one way, certainly, in that he amassed unbelievable wealth because he figured out systematic ways of grabbing it from industry, from individuals. So we're talking here about the birth of totalitarianism.
Well, one of the running themes through your book is the relationship between totalitarianism and the control of family reproduction.
I think there's a very solid connection in that the more ambitious a particular government is, the more inclined it is, to look around and say, well, what are the areas where nobody has dared to trespass and exploit? And obviously one of those areas is reproduction, the most, intimate, consequential area of human life, sex and reproduction and erotic relationships. And if the state says, I want that, I want control over that, then something very, very important has happened in human society.
And as through your book, I come to understand this time period. This is where misogyny becomes law, where there's a lot of women blaming propaganda that starts occurring at the legal level at this point in time.
Yeah. So right around the time that these anti-abortion poems were composed, the Emperor Augustus starts promulgating what we call his moral legislation. We might call it his family values legislation. Okay. So he starts saying that the big problem that Rome has is that there aren't enough babies being born, legitimate babies, babies of good family, babies who are going to be the solid citizen class of the future. There just aren't enough. And it's the fault of women. Women are frivolous. Women are adulterous. Women are not doing their job in building the nation. So he is making laws, and at the same time, I think he leaned on Ovid to write these two very anomalous poems for Ovid. And in those poems, abortion is depicted as the super crime.
Right. Worse than abandoning your children.
Worse than abandoning your children. Worse than killing your children. Worse than genocide. It is a sort of genocide, but it's also an assault on divine law.
Wow.
It is depicted in these poems, abortion. And this is, he's talking about the abortion of a prostitute's or a courtesan's child. So this is according to Roman values, something totally trivial. But it's turned into a crime of celestial importance. It's an assault on the gods' will. It's an assault on the gods' will for the greatness of Rome.
How did the rest of the Roman population view these ideas? Do we know?
I'm sorry. What was that?
How did the rest of the, like, sort of day-to-day Roman population view these extreme ideas?
Well, apparently, we can't really tell because we don't have any record of the reaction to these particular poems. We do have reactions recorded to the family values laws, and ordinary upper class Romans, and this was the main target of the laws. They were baffled and horrified, and they resisted, even though resistance was kind of not a good political idea at the time. But they stood up to the emperor, they evaded the laws, and the whole campaign kind of went to nothing. But it was a hobby horse of Augustus. He was very attached to this campaign, and he didn't care how unpopular it was. He just kept pushing and pushing and pushing.
We're going to run out of time, and I know I'm going to have you back, but I want to talk a little, and we'll start this conversation from probably have to finish it in another interview. I want to talk about the early Christian reproductive backlash, and this is where things start getting really weird. For the early Christian church, the only Christian heroines were martyrs.
Yeah.
That's about a dim view of women as you can possibly get.
Right, yes. Now, this was not foundational, and this was not written into, the Christian program.
Right.
Which is the program that the Apostle Paul was spreading in his missionary work. He had a lot of respect for women, and he included women. There were business women, independent women who were high up, among his helpers, and he praises them, and they could, it's very clear they could speak out in the Christian assembly or the Christian, what came to be called the Christian church. They could just stand up and say whatever they wanted. So that starts to disappear when the church develops paying positions, so men want to grab them. And they start denigrating and excluding the women who had proven themselves, so active and so effective. So these women have to be crushed, and they are associated with the devil. They are told that they have to stay indoors, shut up, have children. Their salvation is supposed to depend on having children, which is an insane distortion of early Christian theology.
And it gets, believe it or not, it gets worse.
It gets totally worse. By the age of martyrdom, okay, so we're now sort of into the late second century, where it becomes, there develops, systematic persecution of Christians, and they're being sent to the arena and killed as a public spectacle. And at that stage, the only participation that is welcome from women is to die. The only thing they're allowed to say when they're dying is, "Oh, it's wonderful to die, for my faith." And so, women being tortured publicly as a spectacle, becomes this sadistic program for, women's public participation. It's really, really horrifying. Now, there's one woman who wrote a prison diary, and she was kind of she's a very, very gutsy young woman, well-educated, articulate, so she writes a prison diary. So we can hear this from her point of view. The diary is slashed to pieces, boulderized, but you can tell how she was, her voice was crushed, how she was exploited. In the male Christian imagination, the only thing proper to do with women, if they're going to be in public at all and are going to stand for their faith is for them to be ripped to pieces.
Then you get to people like the church father Jerome, who basically said women should make vows of chastity, remain childless, and then gift the church the estates that would have gone to the children.
Yeah. So,
how come
exploitation of women. So he's looking around. This is very late now. So we're talking about fourth century and a little later when we're talking about his lifetime. He sees, you know, women's bodies, their inheritance, you know, their vocation as the property of the church. They have Augustine, the saint, Jeremy, okay, they're contemporaneous, and their ideas about women, you know, proved to be very, very important.
Sarah, we're going to unfortunately have to stop right there.
Okay.
Jen, we've just started going. Tonight, my special guest has been Sarah Rudin. She's a leading translator of ancient literature of the West. She's written many books on it. And we're talking about her new book, Reproductive Wrongs, A Short History of Bad Ideas About Women. Sarah, it's a pleasure talking to you. Your book is really scary. But thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.